Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And it is so exciting that we have decided that we will do no more of these radio programs after these 2 hours today for the rest of the year.
Yeah, the rest of the year, we're just going to suspend the show.
Right.
Or program, whatever you want to call it.
You called it a show.
I did.
I'm going to remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's good to know. Anyway, you are listening to a radio program, in case you thought maybe you were listening to something else. And presuming that this is December 28th in the year of our Lord 2013, then you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 773-1400. And somebody is right on the ball, and they're on the air. They're on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I appreciate taking my call. I've been reading a lot about Puerto Rico. I've been reading a lot about Puerto Rico.
You mean the Greece of the Western Hemisphere?
Territory of the United States. A lot of people are calling that America's Greece.
Yes.
Can you comment on their current financial situation? How bad is it? When's it going to implode? And how's that going to affect the market? So I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you. Okay, good question. Puerto Rico is actually not a territory of the United States. It's a commonwealth.
Yeah.
And that is rather poorly defined. There are certain aspects of Puerto Rico that are pretty secure. For instance, if you have an FDIC-insured certificate of deposit in a bank in Puerto Rico, but you better be absolutely sure it is FDIC-insured.
Right, and don't go over the limitation.
Right, then you're in pretty good shape. But what's really happened is Puerto Rico has done a lot of the things that were done in Greece. They don't have all the restrictions that a state has. They're really neither fish nor fowl, and to use a metaphor. And as a result, they have done some of the things that Greece did relative to the European Union Eurozone. They've overspent. They have too big of a bureaucracy going. They have too many people working for the government. They have had a lot of money and relatively little responsibility. The end result has been that they have basically squandered a lot of money and have a lot of difficulties. The likely thing that we're going to see in Puerto Rico, and I forecast this a long time ago, as usual, when I do these things, I was way the heck ahead of myself.
Yes, we've been talking about Puerto Rico for about 8 years now.
And, you know, and I'm sure somebody could have made some really, really good income on Puerto Rican municipal bonds over that period. But, you know, what was the metaphor you used, picking up pennies in front of a steamroller?
Yeah, that's what's been going on there.
So
you can make a lot of money until you're a little slow and the steamroller catches up.
The municipal securities in Puerto Rico, in my opinion, are likely to default. Many of them. The ones that have abnormally high yields. First, they started with high yields. Then, as the specter of anybody who took a serious look at the offering and said, wow, there's no way they can pay this back that I can see, and they sold their bonds, well, then they generally sold them at a loss. And as the bond prices trended lower and the payout remained constant, theoretically, the yields rose, which is what happens in a distressed bond market. And I think one of the issues that has been flip-flopping around, several of the municipal bond insurance companies are either in or teetering on the edge of some form of bankruptcy, and there have been court cases have already been filed where they say the Puerto Ricans, basically the municipality in Puerto Rico, violated some provision of the insurance policy issued by a municipal bond insurance corporation of some kind, And therefore, when they fail, or if they fail, it's more of a when at this point, they're not going to be covered. As far as the rest of the market is concerned, frankly, in the stock and bond markets of the United States, anybody who is any who has any sophistication already knows that is going to blow up, and it's already factored in.
Yeah, this is. We'll go back to that was a complex answer, so I'm going to go back to a really, really simple one. And the simple one is, in the realm of interest rates and low risk, you get low risk, you get low interest.
Mm-hmm.
Those go together. If yeah. you're in a place where you're trying to get a higher interest rate than a bank in the United States would normally give you, and you look around at all the banks that are in the United States, they're FDIC insured, and you say some of them are paying a little bit more over here in this little commonwealth. You say, oh, okay, I'm going to go to that one. It's FDIC insured. That's fine. You get in there, and then you start seeing all the other high-interest stuff that's even better. And that's what's going on. Anytime, it's kind of like this. Here we go. I'm gonna flip it around. If you have great credit, you're walking through, you look at a car, you want to buy the car, you show up, and you say, I have $100,000 in my bank account. I have a very nice stream of income. I have no debt on my credit cards. And you go to the car dealership and you say, I want a loan for a new car. And they say, that'll be 27%. I think most people recognize that those two don't go together. If you've got a really high credit rating, then you shouldn't have a high interest mm-hmm. rate. You're going to take the lowest interest rate that you can get away with when you're getting a loan. That is just part of who we are. If you go to get a home loan and there's one place that's offering a loan for 3% and one place that's offering a loan for 4%, which are you going to take? If you shop around and you have the ability of having a wide mortgage market, you're going to take the lowest one you can find with the lowest fees you can find. That's just what we do. The bank is, in essence, paying on a loan, just like we are on a mortgage. It's just a much shorter term loan. So if you go to a bank in Puerto Rico and they're paying you a little bit more than other banks, it's because they have to. Their credit isn't quite as good. They need to keep more yeah. on reserve. When you get into municipalities, it gets worse because you don't have FDIC anymore. And you get these municipalities that want loans. And municipalities want to get those loans at the lowest rate that they can as well. So if they're giving more interest than other municipalities, it's because they have to.
There's a fundamental principle that has to do with bonds, and that is your risk and your interest rate will be the same. Now, let me explain that. The 10-year U.S. Treasury note this week rose above 3%, which is, in the finance world, big news. And for the rest of you, you kind of scratch your head and say, why is that important? What that says is, if you are the average U.S. Treasury note purchaser, you have an interest rate that you're going to pay, that's they're going to pay you. You're going to pay taxes on that. Now, the average person probably will pay, because of a combination of taxes and so on, something like 0.75% in taxes on that treasury note. In other words, they'll probably pay 20-some percent, let's say 25% taxes. Well, that leaves about 2.25%, somewhere between 2.25%, 2.5%, probably 2.25% as the real payment to the person who bought the note. Now, let me explain that, because the federal government is paying you interest, but they're taking back
taxes.
25%, 28%, maybe even 30%, depending on how much money you make, of that interest they're paying you. And they're going to withhold it, by the way. They don't actually send you the whole interest. They're really smart about this. So if they're withholding interest, you're really only getting about between 2.25, 2.5, probably closer to 2.25%.
It's kind of like Social Security. Yeah. You're not actually getting the number that they tell you you're getting. You're getting that minus the taxes that they're holding out.
Now, here's the key to this. That's why we use, right now, we're using 2.25% as our estimation of inflation over the next 10 years. Why? Because all those folks who are borrowing, who are loaning money to the Treasury in a 10-year Treasury note are under the impression, and this is the way it works, that they have zero risk of not getting their money back in 10 years minus inflation. So what they've done is say, Treasury, since there's zero risk of default,
and the 10-year Treasury right now is paying about 3%.
Right. All we want you to do is compensate us for inflation over the next 10 years because there's zero risk of default. And so that's how we figure that. Now, as soon as you get a higher return on a bond than 3% right now, you are accepting a risk of default. And the higher the interest rate goes, the interest rate goes up arithmetically. However, the risk goes up exponentially. So that, for example, if somebody offered you 6% on a bond, the chances of you really getting 6% to maturity, roughly you have a 50%. Now, this is very rough, and this is just a rule of thumb. Don't hold me to this exactly. But you have about a 50% chance of losing your money.
Yeah, this comes to another point. This is one we've discussed over the past few years, actually, but specifically in the last few months. We get a lot of people that don't understand the U.S. debt situation. United States, we've now gone from Puerto Rico into the overall U.S. debt situation.
Oh, I got some good stuff on that today.
Okay, so using what we've just said about if you own a treasury, a 10-year treasury, and it's paying 3%, what you're actually receiving is somewhere closer to 2.5 or 2.4 after taxes. So the United States government recognizes that when a U.S. citizen owns a treasury note, bill, or bond, that they have less interest to pay to those people. When the Federal Reserve owns the U.S. treasury note, bill, or bond, in essence, it's a 0% loan from the government or to the government because
from the banking system.
Right. Because when the U.S. government pays interest to the Federal Reserve on those bonds, the Federal Reserve turns around and gives it right back. They give the profits from their interest rate manipulations back to the government. That's part of the law. So when the Federal Reserve has been buying up these bonds over the past several years, it's been helping the debt outlook for the United States government. And it is more expensive for the government to have Chinese own the debt than to have Americans own the debt. And it's more expensive for the U.S. government to have Americans own the debt than to have the Federal Reserve own the debt.
And the interesting thing about the Federal Reserve, the money that the United States government owes the Federal Reserve, it is a forgivable debt.
Yes, the Federal Reserve at any point can be told, we don't owe that anymore, and the Federal Reserve goes, okay. I'll just kind of erase these off of our ledger book. Sorry about that. I didn't realize.
You're listening to Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number's in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. It's the same as Social Security and Medicare debt. The U.S. government owes that debt to themselves. That's a, by definition, forgivable debt.
Right.
If you take an IOU from your own bank account and you say, I'm going to pay this back over the next year, what obligation do you really have to do it? Only to yourself. So if you change your mind, you don't have to do it. And the U.S. Congress can change its mind
what?
And say, we don't owe ourselves this money that we've been borrowing from ourselves.
There is this little problem there.
They do have to pay the Social Security if they want to get reelected, but they don't have to pay the back debt that they've accrued.
Well, yeah, and it's the easiest way to explain it is it's complicated. But Puerto Rico is not a threat. It's not a threat
if you have money there.
Yeah, if you happen to be greedy and you have some Puerto Rican bonds and you say they're insured by MBAC or some municipal insurance company and thereby if they default, I get my money back. Well, good luck on that one. It doesn't work that way, in fact. And a lot of high yield. You know, it's funny. There's this cycle over time. High yield bonds are now very popular. And as a matter of fact, I was noticing in the fund flows report that I just read this morning that tremendous amounts of money are flowing out of high-grade corporate bonds, treasuries, and so on, into high-yield bonds. And I have been around long enough now. Folks, we have seen this before. I was trying to explain. I had some people in the office the other day who were, or I had a guy in the office the other day, not a client. And he didn't become a client because he wanted high yield. And I said, do you remember Michael Milliken? And the guy, you know, the guy I was talking to is older than me. He says, Michael Milliken. No.
The name, I'm sure the name rings a bell.
Well, no,
he
said it kind of rings a bell, but I don't know what it was. And I said, is the concept of junk bonds, Oh, yeah. I said, do you know that what we call junk bonds after Michael Milliken and the bond market collapse, we now call high yield bonds?
And before Michael Milliken, they called them high yield bonds.
Right.
After Michael Milliken, when he got all these high yield bonds in these portfolios and then collapsed, he went to prison over it because he was calling them high yield instead of junk. Well they started calling it junk again.
Well, now we're
back to high yield.
And the thing is about high yield bonds, there's often a lot of under the table deals going on here too that you don't know about. So
that's very uncomfortable. Have you ever done an under the table deal? I mean, I keep hitting my
there's
head.
A lot of sticky gum.
Every time there's crumbs. There's
right.
usually some dogs
no,
walking
I
around down there.
I don't do under the table deals.
I did on Christmas. I made a deal with my niece, who's 3 years old. We traded a roll under the table.
So it was under the table
trading deal. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well.
That's what happened. I mean,
so did she
the dog
roll you?
Almost got involved?
Well, that happens. Yeah. That's one of the things because once it falls from the table,
right.
it belongs to the dog.
Yeah.
Well, therein is a valuable lesson. People who get greedy, who want higher returns than are safe. When you're dealing with a true professional in the area of finance, and they tell you that if you go any higher, your safety is at risk, and people say, "I don't care, I'll be willing to take risk." My experience with people who want to take that kind of risk is they'll take as much risk as they're willing to take any level of risk as long as they don't lose any money.
But, right.
and
which is
one of the
kind of silly.
One of the things I want to emphasize to anybody and everybody. And we're coming up on that time when these things happen, is that there is no such thing as wealth without risk. Whatever his name, Gibbons, who published that book years ago, Wealth Without Risk, had certainly a speckled and criminal background at the time and has since kind of disappeared. There is no such thing. The issue is you manage the risk. If you want to have wealth, if you want to have more money than you save or invest, you're going to take risk. And the issue is understanding the risk, managing the risk, and only taking acceptable risks from which you have a clear path to recovery. That is such fundamental, such critical advice. And yet I fear that many people, including the Wall Street Journal finance reporters, sometimes do not understand that at all. It's a crucial thing to understand. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, by the way, and this is a commercial radio station, KTEM 1400. And as a result, we have to play commercials. And it's a commercial radio station. We play commercials where people pay the radio station to broadcast stuff. That is a technical term. So we're going to play some commercial stuff, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And you can give us a telephone call in here and ask about anything that has to do with finance or the economy or whatever. 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
You're running a little slow over there.
Yeah, I didn't realize that you were going to stop with the word or.
What else would I say?
Or you can also reach us at or or I guess or. I just wasn't expecting or.
Oh, well,
that'll
you
teach
should,
me.
You should, when you mine, you should expect or.
I should lower my expectations.
By the way, I do want to acknowledge to the listener who called in or who left a voicemail message for us.
Which we will be playing next week with names removed.
No.
Oh, I think it's worthwhile.
No. That even though we're not very funny, we can't help ourselves, and this is how we make it through 2 hours of talking to phone balls, is by laughing at ourselves,
even if
we're not funny.
Well, the entire staff at our office laughed uproariously over the last week over a voicemail that was left for us during the radio program, explaining that this particular listener really, really liked our show. Our program was amazing.
And by the way, thank you for liking it.
But that we weren't funny, so we should avoid humor, and any attempt at humor was falling flat, so we should use our time more wisely.
Yes. And we should say things like, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has a 52-week change of 27.36% at this point as we approach the end of the year. Year-to-date, it's up 25.75%. This week, it was up 1.59%.
Followed immediately.
The S&P 500. 52-week rise of 31.30%. Year-to-date, is up 29.11%. Weekly, this week, it was up 1.27%. It was truly a Santa Claus rally. Was that humorous?
No. Okay. A penny saved is a penny earned.
Maybe.
The problem with not using humor, even unfunny humor, which we find it funny, so we may laugh at our own jokes, is it gets very boring for us.
Yes, and we have to sit here for 2 hours and talk to foam balls.
If you really wish us to speak of something interesting and stop being humorous,
call us and ask.
Call
us. Yeah, you'll notice
us.
We get serious.
Yes.
When somebody calls and asks an economic question or a question about investing or something like that, we get really, really serious for a while.
But that voicemail caused a lot of people in the staff where we abide during the week to think that was quite funny, that they thought that was the funniest thing that they've heard all week or all year, that we are not funny.
And they're the people who tell us what to do. So we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
I have the answer.
What?
Offer them their money back, 100% of what they paid to listen.
Oh,
that's
it. Why didn't we think of that?
No, I want to do better than that. I will give them double their money back.
We're going to double it.
And just for the record,
that's two zeros. And everybody knows if you put more zeros on the end of a number, it gets bigger.
It gets bigger.
Yeah.
We're being humorous.
South Dakota.
I just read an article today on trusts in South Dakota.
Right.
Yes.
Are you familiar with that? And can you talk about that for a moment or two?
They're really cold.
Listen, have a wonderful new year.
Right.
All right.
Trusts in South Dakota tend to be really cold.
Yes, particularly in the winter.
Right. And
are you familiar with this?
There's also some really good trusts in Alaska, and now they're in Arizona. Is it Arizona? No, they're in Utah, and I think there's also similar trusts popping up in California.
Right. Let me give some background on trusts. I can hand it over to you if you want to talk specifically about South Dakota.
I'd love to hear about you talk about the trusts in South Dakota.
All right. I'm going to give some background. As of the beginning of this year, there was an estimate that we have about $483 billion in trusts in the United States. People hear that and they go, that's not a lot of money. It isn't a lot of money, because when you consider that we're talking about right around $200 trillion in assets in the United States, that's the total everything, assets of everything. So we're talking about $189 trillion.
Just $200 trillion?
It's a lot of money. If you think of all the real estate and all of the stocks and all of the structures and houses and everything else in the United States.
And dirt.
And you realize that only $483 billion are in trusts. And that's because there are problems with trusts. Trusts, if they earn money that aren't specifically tailored to the trust, get taxed at a very, very high interest rate. Well, if you have a very large portfolio, and we're not talking about the $10 million portfolio anymore. Now we're getting into the several tens of millions of dollar portfolio. And once you get up into that area, if you die A very large percentage of that goes to the U.S. government.
May I make a correction?
Yes.
With a couple of notable exceptions, it shouldn't be an if.
What are we talking about?
It's not if you die.
Oh, if you die. If you die.
No. When you die.
Okay. When you die, the U.S. government wants a big chunk of that. So even those very, very wealthy people that are invested only in very conservative municipal bonds that are coming back to them, they're doing this for tax purposes, they've got it in. When they die, they're still going to have to pay estate taxes on these big things. So the thought way back was, we'll put it in a trust, because a trust is an entity of its own and it doesn't die. Well, most of the states in the United States said that trusts will stop being trusts at some point. They will,
right,
in essence, die.
It's called the law against perpetuities.
Right.
And so, if you've ever seen a perpetuity running around, you'd understand why there are laws against
them. Chased them a few times, but right. I get bored. It's just too long to chase.
They never end.
Yeah. So South Dakota was one of the first to say, we're going to do, they're being labeled legacy trusts.
Since they're in perpetuity, they have really good legs.
Right. And basically what it's saying is that these trusts never go away, according to the law of the state.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people are putting money in trusts that are established in South Dakota. Now, when I say a lot of people, I'm saying really we're talking
they've got a better one in Alaska, though. A
couple of hundred people total that are putting money in, but they're putting money in very large quantities,
mm-hmm,
because they've decided that if they structure the money inside the trust, the investments inside the trust properly, so they're not paying income tax on any of that, then they can be taking money out in small doses for income over their lifetimes and the lifetimes of their kids and grandkids and great-grandkids, mm-hmm, and so on, without right. having to pay the tax every time somebody dies. If when I die, if I've passed that on in a trust, then the estate tax is not taken out of it, and then the death of my offspring, the estate tax isn't taken out, and so on. It is a direct protest against the concept of the death tax, the estate tax, which I think is pretty dumb. I don't like it. If you're paying taxes your whole life on everything that you're earning, and you have paid taxes, you say you bought something for $50,000, it's now worth $100,000. Well, change that to millions. You bought something for $50 million, it's now worth $100 million. You liquidate it. You have to pay taxes on the gains. That's $50 million of taxes, of taxable gains. So you're paying some percentage of that. Now you have something like, I don't know, $70 million. If you died the next day after paying that huge amount of taxes, your heirs now own something approaching 50% taxes on everything above $10 million. That doesn't sound fair to me.
Yeah, and let me emphasize something here. I think there's probably not a lot of people right now who are listening to the show.
There are a few people in the area that could have that.
Right.
In the vicinity of that amount of money.
I just wanted to be very pointedly, I want to make this point very strongly. The current estate tax exclusion per person is $2.5 million, roughly. And if the first of a couple to die as an executor who is competent and who files their estate tax return properly, they owe nothing at $2.5 million, but 100%, there is no estate tax on transfer from spouse to spouse.
I'm trying to figure out where you're getting that $2.5 million.
What is it?
It's $5.25 million.
Is that per individual?
Per individual.
Okay.
When it transfers to, simple thing in your will, you can transfer that to your spouse, and then it's $10.5 million.
$10 million. I'm sorry. I'm operating
on old numbers.
On old numbers.
You're talking
from
about
last
numbers
year.
From 2000.
Yeah, well, I'm
nine.
Right, okay.
2009. There
so it's $10 million. Basically, if a person has $5 million and they die, they don't pay estate taxes. But this is very important. the executor needs to file a state tax return anyway. And that estate tax return, the executor states, claims the tax deduction for the first person to die.
It, out of two spouses.
Right. And therefore, when the second person dies, that part of the money that transferred to the second person, the surviving spouse.
Only to spouses.
You can really easily wind up very quickly with a $10-plus million estate tax exclusion without anything fancy, without any trusts, without anything. Now, there's valid reason to have trusts in addition to that if you want to. But frankly, I don't think Congress is going to lower that number at any point. And the reason is...
Well, it did. It just raised it back up because it was...
Well, actually, it went to zero.
It went to zero for a year.
And then they put it at $10 million. But the point is, I don't think they're going to come below that $10 million, effective $10 million for couple position.
Right.
And the reason is, the people who contribute to political campaigns generally have more money than the people who don't.
Really?
So, when we have a caller on...
Well, we can get back to that subject later, but...
866-597-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, I'm with Chris in Georgetown.
Hi, Chris.
How are you? I think you guys are really funny. I don't know what that caller's talking about.
Well, funny looking is different from humorous.
Yeah, well, they
funny,
Chris, you actually come into the office and look at us.
Okay.
That's why you laugh every time I give you advice. Okay, I got it now. Okay. You actually think I'm going to do that?
So I have an anecdotal, I guess, about Obamacare. Just a story. So I work for a small company out of Austin, and we have health insurance subsidized to the state of Texas. And they're a small business. I don't know what it's called. But since Texas did not take part in Obamacare, our subsidy did not get canceled because Texas did not take part in that. And I just wanted to, you know.
You work for the state?
Huh?
You work for the state?
No, I don't work for the state, but our health insurance is subsidized to the state of Texas.
No. No, yeah, that we're on the same group program.
It's subsidized to the state of Texas. I mean, the taxpayers pay for it by subsidizing.
No, I don't think so.
I think unless you're on Medicaid, that's not the case.
No, the way that the state of Texas has a plan that is amazingly like Obamacare, that it allows, but it's only for small businesses. Small businesses can form groups with relatively small numbers of people, and they can bid for health insurance as though they were a big, gigantamous corporation. They get the same. In other words, if let's say the Scott and White healthcare system, Scott and White health plan, provides a certain rate to a company with 5,000 employees, they basically have to provide the same or a very similar rate to the Personal Wealth Coach with 10 employees, and as a result, we get much less expensive health care than if we were to go out and try to buy it under other circumstances. There is a law in the state of Texas that basically says all of the small businesses in a given area constitute a single group.
Subsidy like where the taxpayers help us fund our insurance?
No, there is something. Texas has a law, and you can go to Texas or txhealthpool.org. They have a law where there is a pooled rate where they take all the rates of the major insurance carriers and they average it. And then they say there's a maximum rate that may be charged. That is the extent of there's no subsidy there. They're just saying you can't charge more than this. They want people to make a living, but they don't want to be squeezing customers in the process. Medicaid, on the other hand, is a subsidized state-funded program for very low-income people.
Okay.
When Texas did not accept the subsidies from Obamacare, basically they didn't extend the pool that their Medicaid group covered.
Okay, maybe I was thinking of it wrong, the way it was done. So we're basically pooling all the small businesses are pooling their resources together to get a better insurance, rate.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's a cafeteria plan, basically. You get a big group of people together, and then your rates go down because you're diversifying your risk.
Very frankly, Texas is not accepting additional money from the federal government. Had no effect on that.
Yeah.
Right.
Now,
correct.
In the long run,
that helped us as a small business, and we're small. I mean, really, really small.
No, it did. It had no effect on your rates. Texas
right.
is.
I mean, if Texas would have accepted what Obamacare is doing, then our insurance policies would have been canceled.
No,
and we would have
absolutely not. No,
correct. Yeah. What's going on?
The federal law. Let me
go ahead.
The federal law concerning the minimum health care benefit is not affected by whether or not Texas accepted Medicare funding.
Correct.
And it's actually Medicaid funding. What happened is. Now your rates will remain higher than they otherwise would have been because Texas turned down the money. Because what happens is, because Texas chose not to extend Medicaid to some additional low-income people with using federal money, those people in most cases will not get health insurance, and they will show up in the emergency room, and your insurance premium, just like mine, will have to be higher in order to pay for the people who show up in the emergency room who have no insurance. And that's just the way it is.
A lot of people that, with Obamacare rules, a lot of our people's insurance being canceled, all of a sudden all these people are getting canceled. So I guess Walgreens or CVS or one of the companies, all the insurance, their insurance, health insurance is being canceled. What is? I mean, I don't understand that. So why do people complain that their health insurance?
Okay, now let me explain that. Let me explain that. And what's happened is, let's just say, I don't know if it was Walgreens, but let's say there's an employer who's been carrying a group health policy. Obamacare, and the reason they have a group health policy is because a lot of their employees can't get health insurance coverage as individuals because they have pre-existing health conditions, and so it's an employee benefit, and it costs the company money to do this.
Right.
Not just premium money. It costs them administrative money to run the program. Now, Obamacare comes along and says the employees can now buy effectively group health coverage on their own from whatever provider they want without regard to pre-existing conditions. A lot of companies have taken a look at that situation and says, okay, we can take the subsidy money, the money that we're applying towards every individual's health care premium, and we'll just give them that money and say, go buy your own health insurance because you're going to get it at a same or lower price than we could get it now, and we don't have to worry about the administration anymore.
Now, the major cancellations aren't taking place at corporations. They're not taking place at big companies that have a big plan. There's some of that going on, but most of the cancellations that we're hearing about, people hear the number 5 million passed around. What that really is the plans that existed before Obamacare didn't cover everything that said that needed to be covered under Obamacare. Now, for some people, they decided that that was enough. They wanted only some specific coverages. And this is where it goes back to the problem that the president had over saying, if you like your doctor or you like your plan, you get to keep it. That plan that he was talking about, those plans renew every year. So if you had a plan before 2010 that didn't renew every year like every other plan in existence, then you got to keep it. And that's a problem. That's an outright lie. The plans that he was talking about where people had said, I've got all the coverage I need and I don't want more, those plans that have since been renewed don't meet the Obamacare standard anymore. And those are the ones that are getting canceled, and they're usually by individuals that are in good health, which is why you're hearing so much about it, because when they turn around, the next plan that's being offered to them is more expensive because they're individuals in good health, but they're helping to pay for other people who are not in good health.
Well, it's not just that. No, it's not just that. Many of these plans had very, very limited coverage, the ones that are being canceled.
But not all of them.
Many of the plans had
Correct.
Very, very limited coverage and extremely high deductibles.
Yeah.
And
so, I mean, why do you want this high deductible then? Does that mean because you're in good health and you don't want to pay?
Basically, if you get something
wrong and not and
right.
not.
It's
pay,
called.
And you want to pay when, like, something happens really bad. You want to, yep. That's when you want insurance.
It's catastrophic insurance, and some of these had $15,000 deductibles. So you pay the first $15,000 of all your
right.
charges. After that, the insurance company pays 80% up to a certain point. And the problem with a $15,000 deductible is that a lot of the people who had $15,000 deductibles didn't have $15,000 to
correct.
Pay down on. Healthcare. They got the $15,000 deductible with kind of the "I'll cross my fingers and hope I never get sick" situation.
Yeah.
And so they are the people who show up who have an illness that costs them, let's say, $10,000 or $12,000 right after they lost their job or something similar, and they don't pay the bill. And when they don't pay the bill again, that causes everybody else's insurance premiums to go up.
This comes to a solution point. Because this is a problem that is across the board. There's a couple of things. I've been asked to say, what would I do to fix it? Well, there's some very simple things that I would start with. Right now we have HSAs and MSAs, and there's a medical savings
right.
account and a health savings account. Now, health savings account was a very short-lived idea that's still around in some people's plans. If you get one of those catastrophic coverage plans, you take the money that you're saving in premium, and you put it in this savings account that is tax protected, and you
mm-hmm.
can use that savings account to buy medical stuff. Again, we use the stuff because that's a technical term for so many things. It's stuff.
Right. It's basically everything that has to do with your health.
Right. Chiropractic care, even toothbrushes.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And it was designed so that if you had a $15,000 deductible and you were saving $600 a month, and you were putting that $600 a month over time into this HSA, you would eventually get $15,000 in there. And that would be self-insurance for the deductible.
Right.
Well, Congress changed that law to say that the only people that qualified for an HSA were people with really high deductibles. And that the standard for really high is different if you're married, it's different if you're in a group plan, it's different if you're in a family, and it's different if you're single. So, again, Congress just got in there and mixed everything up. So then you have the MSA, which is the medical savings account, which is concept is very similar. You get to put money in there, and when you get put the money in there, you get to spend that money on medical stuff. But if at the end of the year you have money in there, it goes away.
And I've been trying to figure out where it goes away, too.
Well, it just disappears. I think there is a big magic.
Does it go back to the employer?
No, there's a dimensional gate that where all the socks go in the dryer, that the money just disappears into that dimensional gate.
Anyway.
And that, to me, sounds.
She works at a surgery center, and people all of a sudden spend all their money before the end of the year.
Exactly, because
right. yeah.
there's a race to buy 12 toothbrushes
yeah,
and
we had,
such
right.
at the end of the year. It's insane. It's a piece of stupidity in the law. If you're going to allow somebody to save money so that they can help pay their deductible, don't make it go away every year.
Do you know why, and this is an interesting point, do you know why they put that limitation on there? I looked that one up.
Yeah, I know
because
why.
Because of the Balanced Budget Act.
Right.
And what happened is, if people are saving all this money and they're not paying taxes on it, that's equivalent of a tax deduction.
Right. And there were lots of things that were allowing them to invest the money as if it were an investment account instead of a savings
right.
account.
And then they never pay the money on it. They never pay taxes on it because they spend it on medical stuff. Then obviously that theoretically will reduce tax revenue to the United States government. Therefore, there had to be an offset someplace and a reduction in spending.
This is another one of the things that I wanted to bring up. Part of the problem, the reason why they canceled the original plan, which was a good one, this HSA thing, well, they didn't really cancel it. It still exists grandfathered in certain plans, is because there were these mutual funds that were going in there, and people were investing for long-term investment planning in there, which makes sense if you're thinking way down the road of long-term care. But it doesn't make sense if you're using it as self-insurance, because then if the market drops right when you're in the hospital, you're kind of out of luck. I think they should put some limitations. Until you reach a certain amount of money, you have to have that much money in cash mm-hmm. in the savings account. And then if you want to invest for long term, you should be allowed to do that too. I think that they should allow people to put money in there. And then if you're going to spend it on anything other than medical, then you should have penalties on that. But to the idea that you shouldn't allow people to put money away to pay for their own stuff, to me, means that we're more dependent on insurance companies than we need to be. That's right. It's the beginning. There are many solutions that spring out of that, but that's the beginning.
Let me emphasize something. The places where medical, the reason, and I realize that there's a lot of warts and pimples in Obamacare, but I also recognize that the places where it's already been implemented, two states, Hawaii and Massachusetts, it was implemented by the states. The cost of insurance premiums to people who had private insurance in those areas, because they were buying the private insurance, dropped and have been dropping. The cost of medical care dropped and has been dropping. And that's really what it's all about, is that there's a fundamental issue here that underlines this entire picture. And that is, unless something big was done, medical costs in the United States would wind up bankrupting the entire country. We spend between 1.5 and 2 times the amount of money per patient in the United States on people that they do in other places where the health care rating is better.
Yeah, and it's part of that is because we're setting the mandate on what is allowed to be spent on certain things, and we're not setting a mandate on where the money comes from. Anyway, we're about out of...
So the premiums go down in Massachusetts and Hawaii. Well, I mean, is everybody else's medical cost going up, though? I mean, just because the premiums go down doesn't mean the medical cost of everybody else isn't going up.
We're out of time.
Sorry, Chris, we're out of time. We'll talk about this more next hour, okay?
We'll talk a bit more next hour.
Okay, thanks for calling.
If you would like to contact us off the air, because we're about out of time this hour, you can reach us by voicemail locally at
947-1111.
You can also reach us toll-free at the same voicemail at 800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, or you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. We've got podcasts of more of our lack of humor. And
we'll be back next hour with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
Your Fox News station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.